We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
For all the knocking about families, about marriage as an institution, that who wants to live in an institution, about the problems with parents and the problems with kids, and the inevitable problems with mother-in-laws, never father-in-laws. For all those kinds of things, people gain great benefits from living in families. It's a very popular pastime, family life. The advantages of love and support and strength and correction and finance and, well, it just goes on and on, the advantages of living in a family. But with family living comes responsibilities. None of the advantages are maintained unless people play part in the network of responsibilities and obligations that is also part of family life. The sending of Christmas cards and doing of the Christmas visit, the attending of those incredible weddings of cousins that you've never met, the funerals of uncles and aunts that you only vaguely have remembered meeting, the occasional telephone call, or the more consistent washing up and picking up and bed making and that goes with living with parts of the family. It's all part of the responsibilities and obligations involved in that social structure that gives us so many advantages and benefits. Nearly all of us here live in a natural family, even though sadly for many of us that family has been fractured by distance or locality, by death or divorce. Yet we nearly all have some sense of family, some sense of cousins and sisters and aunts and uncles and parents and grandparents. Even if they're a long way away, even if we're almost out of touch these days, it's still there as part of our background for nearly all of us. And for many of us, there is the family with whom we are actually at the moment still living. But for those of us who are in Christ Jesus, we also have a spiritual family, with a great added joy that comes if we care to pay part in the responsibilities for the advantages and blessings that come from the Christian family are just as enormous. All who are born of God's Spirit have God as their Father, and Jesus is glad to call them brothers and sisters. We share in the family of God Himself, with brothers and sisters, and with Jesus, our great older brother. This membership of a spiritual family has incredible advantages for us. But of course, with it must come the responsibilities of family life. But we, who are in Christ, have the benefit of natural family life, for nearly all of us, and a second family, which I've termed here for distinctions purposes, a spiritual family. Now, Paul is writing to a young minister, a younger colleague. He may have been in his 30s or even older than that by this stage of his life, but for Paul's view, he is still a younger man. And as such, as a young minister, Timothy is to take his place within the spiritual family. He is to treat the elders as elders, with giving them the due deference that their age and place requires. He is to treat the younger people as brothers and sisters in the Lord. His position of ministry does not give him a title or a role which would ignore age as an important consideration in social relationships. He is not to see himself as so high as to place himself over and above those who are his elders, even though he may have to command them and instruct them and teach them and not allow them to look down upon him. Yet he is still to treat the older men as fathers, the older women as mothers. But there are two pieces of advice in that opening verse, or opening two verses, that are distinctive. The older women and the younger men are straightforward. But for the older men and the younger women, there are two particular pieces of advice that he gives. To the older men, Timothy is directed not to be harsh in his rebukes. Rather, his exhortations are like the exhortations he should give to his father. In our present society, we tend to bomb out so badly on the exhortations we give to our fathers that maybe that advice is not exactly what Paul means. It is important to make our point when speaking to our fathers in such a way as to continue to recognise their dignity and the place that God has given them over us. No father enjoys being told by his children how to live. But yet a godly father will listen to the advice even of his children, especially, of course, if it is offered in humility, with due deference to the fact that he is their father. It is that due deference and humility that Timothy must offer to the older men as he rebukes them, not in harshness, but with gentleness. The second piece of special advice is concerning younger women. They are to be related to as sisters, just as the younger men are to be related to as brothers. But yet they are to be treated with absolute purity. This is an obvious trap, an obvious snare for all who would minister the gospel of Jesus Christ, all who are involved in Christian ministry. It is of great importance that both in fact and in the sight of all men, that one treats younger sisters, treats their sisters in Christ, with absolute purity, so that the evil one can bring no slander against us. It's very important in family life, it's very important in the spiritual family, that there be no imputation of guilt in the treatment of young brothers to young sisters, and in particular those young brothers who are engaged in Christian ministry. It is for that reason that we need particularly to pay attention in the way in which we minister to each other across that sex difference. There's great advantage and wisdom in the idea of young men ministering to young men and young women to young women. Tremendous advantage and wisdom in it. For the appearance of purity is important, as is the purity. It's important in our motivation that there can be nothing brought against us as we treat each other in godliness. And so in those two areas in particular, Timothy is to take his role within the family. But yet there is another group in the family that Paul is mainly concerned with and goes to some length to discuss, as we will this week and again next week. That is the place and role of widows. We are dealing, of course, centuries before the idea of the widow's pension or social security and services that can be offered to people. In fact, we are dealing to some extent in some of the very earliest legislation ever brought in for the care of widows. Earlier still, of course, was the legislation of the nature of the people of Israel, and that beautiful passage in Leviticus 25 there that was read for us, where there is such concern for people that we perceive all Israelites as being in the family, and that you're not to treat them callously, even when through their own fault and folly they may fall into debt. Yet there is great restrictions as to how one Israelite is to treat another Israelite. For after all, they are all part of God's people. Likewise, as Christians, we have particular responsibility to honour the widows who are faithful to Jesus Christ, who are in that spiritual family that we are in. In the spiritual family, it is important that we honour widows, just as it is important in the natural family. That is, those widows who are in real need are the ones that we're to honour. Not all widows has the church got such responsibility for, but those who are in need. And who are they? Well, Paul specifies it as those who are alone, who have no natural family to look after them. If they have a natural family to look after them, then that is the responsibility of that family, that they should look after them, as we'll see in a few moments. But to those who do not have a natural family to look after them, then indeed it is the responsibility of our family to be caring for them. For they are the ones who have no one to turn to. Verse 5 describes them in these terms. The widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. It is those who are truly all alone to whom we have most our responsibility and obligation as a family. But it is also those who are godly. And so in verse 5, that widow who is all alone, who in her isolation and loneliness and lack of family and people to care for her, she puts her trust in God. She prays to him night and day. She asks him for help, for she has no one else to be asking. It is the godly widow, not the ungodly. For notice verse 6. But the widow who lives for pleasure is dead even while she lives. The living corpse, the ungodly one, who does not give herself committed to the cause of God, doesn't turn to God for help and prayer, but actually makes her way in the world as one of the world. Those who are giving themselves to disillusion and ungodliness, as indeed they are coming to disillusion, they are not the ones that Paul says we should be caring for. This is a family matter. He's not asking us to be responsible for caring for all widows in the community. He is asking us to be responsible for the widows of our family who are in the Christian spiritual unit. Those ones we have particular responsibility for. Those who are truly alone and those who are truly godly, putting their trust in him and praying night and day. The godly widow whose only hope is God, she is to be honoured within the spiritual family. This, of course, is a reversal of human values. For such a person who has no hope in this world, who has lost all family and relatives and lost those people who would care for her, such a person whose life is committed but to prayer, such a person in such poverty, is someone that the world dishonours, despises, looks down on, laughs about in their age, in their infirmity, in their social weakness. But yet, that is the person that we are called to honour. And the honouring that is involved is both our esteem that we give to her as a godly person, but also the care that we provide for her. The care financially, the care in provisions, in affection, and society, and fellowship, and prayer. She is our responsibility, and we must joyously take it upon us. There may be in our society other groups like the groups of the widow in the first century. I'm not sure that we should limit it to only widows. Widows in the first century were a particular group who had great problems financially and within the society. Maybe in our day, Paul would stretch that beyond the widows to other people. The elderly single person. I'm sure Paul would not want him to be excluding at this point. It's just that in his society, such a person didn't exist. Which in our society, such a person exists quite frequently. Those whose partners have deserted them is another group. Those who are suffering some disabilities. I'm sure it's the principle of caring for the person in need that we should pay attention to, rather than limiting ourselves pharisaically, as I would think it would be, to just looking for widows and checking out that they are truly widows and nothing else. But those who are alone, who have got no one to care for them except God, and to those who are seeking to live in godliness, if they're members of our family, then we, the family, are responsible for them. Financially, prayerfully, in fellowship, we should honour them. But what of our own families? What are the relationships and what about the responsibilities and advantages that reside still in our natural families, not just our spiritual family of congregational life? Clearly in verse 4, children and grandchildren have the responsibility to care for their parents and grandparents. This is but putting religion into practice. This is but repaying our forefathers for the benefits that they have given to us. It may not be easy or pleasant, and frequently goes against the grain of our self-centeredness, of course, but it is an important principle of Christian living. It can be played upon by the elderly and used to manipulate people in their guilt and responsibility. Yet the honouring of parents is pleasing to God. I presume verse 4 refers to the idea of Christian parents, for it does not say if anybody has parents or grandparents, but rather if there are any parents who have children or grandchildren, any widow in that position. It is still the godly widow that is being referred to. That person has a particular demand upon us. What to do with the ungodly grandparent? Well, I'll mention in a moment or two. It is pleasing to God to honour our mother and father, for if you remember, that is part of the Ten Commandments. We have a tendency to take honour your mother and father to a stop somewhere at the age of 18 to 21. That once you have moved to this state, honour no longer is relevant. The Bible does not view it like that. Certainly, there is a shift once one marries and moves out of home and establishes your own home. A shift in obedience, a shift in setting up your own home that involves leaving your parents. But honour to your parents must never cease. That individualism that cuts myself off from responsibility and benefit, I may say, of my parents is totally ungodly. It is a paganism of this world in particular, of this society in particular. Some of our friends from overseas who come and study with us are shocked, and rightly so, for the abuse of the elderly that they see within the community, the callousness with which we treat our elderly. Christians are to honour their parents and their grandparents. It is right in that it is repaying them. It is right in that it is pleasing to God. It is right in that it is putting Christian religion into practice. It's important for us to do this, for we do not wish to be open to blame, he says in verse 7. If we do not care for our parents and grandparents, then we do open ourselves to blame, for even the unbelievers know that this is a right thing to do. Even unbelievers know that to ignore the needs of your parents and grandparents is indeed a godless thing, an immoral thing. Even the unbelievers care for their parents and grandparents. So that if we do not provide for our relatives, we are worse than unbelievers, he says in verse 8. We're not practicing the faith. We're in fact denying the faith. It's a terrible indictment upon Christians, so busy working down at the church that they do not even care for their elderly. That is a terrible denial of the gospel of Jesus. For God is a God who is concerned for the widows, for the fatherless, for those who are in need. If we are worshipping the God who cares for people in need and yet ignore those who are our responsibility and are in need, what kind of proclamation of the gospel are we declaring? That is a denial of the gospel. We've actually slipped into doing things that even unbelievers will not do. But it's difficult, isn't it? It's very difficult in a selfish society such as our own, very difficult to fulfil our responsibilities, especially when the family we live in has undergone division through divorce, or undergone division through our belief in the gospel, or undergone division through just the hostility of selfish people who can no longer get on with each other. Our relatives quite often have practiced selfishness most of their lives. And we have been well practiced in selfishness ourselves, haven't we? It makes it very hard to live in a way of generosity and care for our relatives. Yet it is obligatory for Christians to provide and to honour their family responsibilities. Please remember that that is the principle, not the detail. The detail of your family and their requests and their demands may be such that you should take no action. It is of interest, you see, that Paul sees within the responsibility of the Christian family for the widows that he is only enjoining us to care for the widows who are godly. That is, are members of the family. But in the natural family, sometimes you have grandparents who are ungodly, but that doesn't mean they're not in your family. Sometimes you may wish that they weren't, but they are. What do you do for them? And does that mean you have no responsibility for them? No, I believe you still have responsibility for them. But you do not have responsibility to prop up their ungodliness. Our feelings of responsibility can easily be used to manipulate us into taking actions for them, which are only supporting their selfish disillusion. That is a problem for us. Real problem for us. You see, should you ever put Grandma in a convalescent hospital, that is a heartache that nearly every family in Australia goes through. It is a very, very difficult choice to make. And there is no single answer. It depends on your family. It depends on you. It depends on your grandmother, doesn't it? Or your mother. In each situation, it will be different. The principle that the Christian operates under is that he has an obligation to care for his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents if they're still alive. We have a responsibility to care for them. But just as you do not give to a child everything they demand, you may not give to an elderly person everything they demand either, especially when their demands are hurtful and harmful to them and clearly can be seen so. Certainly it's true that there are too many people who duck their obligations by institutionalising others, and Christians must not be guilty of doing that. Yet, on the other hand, there are some situations in which institutionalisation is the only alternative, and that is the most caring thing to do for people. I know a man who has two elderly mothers that he has responsibility for, his and his wife. His wife's mother will not live with them. She cannot stand her own daughter. And though he and his wife are willing to have her stay with them, she would not stay with them under any circumstances. If it was the only house left standing in Australia, she wouldn't live there. Now, of course, that operates magnificently on guilt. Because although they're willing to help, she is constantly manipulating them by saying, "You don't care for me." And they say, "Well, you can come and stay with us." And they say, "I wouldn't stay with you." Now, you see, that man's in a no-win situation, isn't he? Yet, out of his concern and care for her, he may have to find other accommodation for her. He will obviously be manipulated. She's a very cantankerous old lady. Very cantankerous, very difficult for everybody with whom she has any association. She has given herself to being unpleasant. Now, it doesn't absolve him of his responsibility, but he must not feel guilt for her unpleasantness. His own mother, on the other hand, is more difficult. But to his great relief, she lives in Brisbane. She has reached her 90s and can no longer live at home alone. She's had several falls, she's had a stroke. It is unsafe for her to live at home alone. But to take her out of Brisbane is to take her out of any context of understanding she has of life. She's lived all her life there. To bring her to Sydney is an impossibility. For him to move is an impossibility. You see, you can't just make a blanket rule and say you must never institutionalise your parents or grandparents. But you can make a rule that you must always care for them and act responsibly in obligation to them, to seek to do that, seek to provide that which is best for them. That is our obligation. That is our responsibility, which in different circumstances of life will differ. From person to person, it will change how that's worked out in detail. It's a difficult area of life, and one which I think people should get together and discuss more often, because it seems that parents have a tremendous, and grandparents and elderly people have a tremendous knack and capacity for making you feel rotten, doesn't matter what you do. And that guilt feeling is bad. But it's made worse, of course, by a society where people are actually, in fact, guilty of neglect and carelessness concerning their elderly. We as Christians must be different in our principles. But it's not just principles. While I wish to emphasise it's a principle so that we will see these individual variations, it's not just principle, it must be action. This is, as Paul says in verse 4, putting religion into action. You profess belief in the God who cares for those who are without, for those who are in difficulty. All right, then, put it into action with those whom are your responsibility. For this is the behaviour of godliness. Indeed, this is the very character of God, to do this kind of thing. We have tremendous benefits, friends, in being in a spiritual as well as a natural family. But that tremendous benefit also, of course, means we've got greater responsibilities. I'm not only responsible for my own parents, grandparents, but I'm also responsible for those in my family here who are in need, who are lonely, who are cut off, who are without family, whose family may have kicked them out and take no responsibility for them. But for those who are in genuine need, they too are our responsibility. Yet, of course, they are our joy as well, aren't they? That we actually have a large and extended family of people who care for us and for whom we can care. That is a tremendous privilege that almost nowhere else in society you can find. For everywhere else, people are locked into little singular families that keep on breaking up and hurting and destroying. There is great benefit in family living, in the natural as well as the spiritual, but the benefit requires responsibility. We will enjoy it as we act properly. Do you want to ask questions or make comments about what we said? Or what Paul is saying here? Narelle. A bit louder, sorry. Narelle asked the question whether I could give some practical suggestions about how we care for people who are in this particular spiritual family. It seems to me that the problem with the church, one of the great problems of the Church of England, has got to do with anonymity in church going. And so although we say we're in the spiritual family, we work our darndest to make sure we never meet anybody. And there's nothing like pleasant family relationships in anonymity. You never fight with anybody. Of course, you never love anybody either. You never care for anybody. But then again, nobody gets in your way, do they? Except for the rush for the door. It is important that we work at getting to know people within the congregation. That seems to me the first key step. Because when you get to know people, then you can get to know those who have got needs and ways in which we can help. And I think very often people are willing to help, but ignorant of the needs. I think that's what I hear you saying yourselves, that people are much more willing to help than they find opportunity to help. And it seems to me the key reason has got to do with they didn't know there was a need. And we, and rightly so, do not seek to burden each other by letting the needs be known. In fact, some of those in greatest need are fiercely independent and make great work at making sure they never let their needs be known so that no one will feel obliged. A little bit more honesty in that area would be helpful. It is actually doing us a kindness to let us serve each other. That's a hard thing to learn, isn't it? That you're actually being helpful to the other person to give them the opportunity to help you. But you are doing that. And so getting to know each other and praying for each other and getting to know each other's needs, that seems to me the great barrier we have in caring for people. On the other hand, let me say that I have no particular recriminations to be levelling. If I had them, I'd say them in no uncertain terms. It's like that Paul's verse in Timothy. I observe you love one another, and I want you to do so more and more. It's not that I observe that you're not caring for each other. I observe in many ways people are, and I wish that you do it more and more. We do not seem to have many elderly widows in the destitute state that this is speaking of. Why in this suburb, I do not know. That's something we need to reflect upon. But sometimes when we do have them, we need to work harder at visiting them and caring for them. We do have, I think, greater difficulties in terms of young mothers. I think they're the group that are greatest, mostly under pressure in our congregational life. And the work of the Women's Bible Study Group in trying to make sure that in those first few weeks back from hospital that meals are provided and things like that seem to me to be a great exercise in this godliness, and we need to work at more and more. And the other group that ours, the congregation, will have are people who are single and away from home. And I think they we'll always have that kind of person within our congregation, and I think we need to work hard at showing hospitality. Those of us who have got families, especially, even though they be young families, I mean, the single person loves to be part of family life, and we should encourage them. And I think it's a good thing always to put your Sunday dinner on, if you put it on before you leave for church, etc., with an extra few spuds in the hope that you'll find someone around church on Sunday that you can invite back for lunch on Sunday.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.